discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us for the 49th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Okay, apologies for that, guys. We're having a little technical issue. I am going to check on what's going on, and I will be right back to you. Okay, guys, apologies for the technical difficulty. We're going to go ahead and move on from the musical portion of the show right now. I will not be asking the name of the show, name of the song and the artist, obviously, but as Dr. Mathis would have mentioned if we didn't have this problem, tonight's episode is going to be entitled, Is There Anybody Out There? Suicide Support System Failure. So before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so what I thought I would do tonight is talk about a guitar that most people don't think of specifically for rock and roll, but it actually has been used a pretty good bit for rock and roll, and that is the Fender Telecaster. So, the typically known as the Tele. It currently now comes in a very wide variety of models and colors, but back in the day when it first came out, it was pretty limited. So it was generally considered the first really commercially viable solid body electric. It was very successful in its day. And even though it had a sort of a prototype model that was done, in the, 1950, by Leo Fender, obviously. It wasn't released until, 51. And it went under a couple of incarnations. So it originally came out as a thing called, it was going to be called the Broadcaster, but Gretsch guitars and drums got pretty PO'd about it because they had a drum kit, a line of drums called the Broadcaster with a K. And even the Broadcaster that Fender was going to put out had a C on it. Gretsch got very unhappy and got legal on them. So they changed the name from Broadcaster to Telecaster. And in the interim, when they were trying to remove the name from the headstock and kind of had no name at the top, They were sort of known as the No-Casters because they didn't have a name. So it was a very, very short-lived variant, which started basically around mid-51. And when they rebranded them and came out, they became the what we now know as a Telecaster. Originally, it was called an Esquire, briefly, which only really had one pickup on it. And then when they came out, they started with the single pickup model of the Esquire. But they also had no truss rod in the neck. So the truss rod is a metal rod in the neck that keeps the wood from, like, bending and breaking and doing all kinds of horrible things that guitar players don't want. So they went, yeah, we can't be doing this one. So when they released the Broadcaster, it had a truss rod in it. And so they went, well, great idea. So when it went bye-bye, when the name went bye-bye, and they came out eventually with Telecaster, they had a truss rod and they had two pickups in the guitar. So one little lipstick-like one in the neck position, which is a little rounder and more mellow, and one in the bridge position, which is kind of like a hot Stratocaster pickup. It's a lot hotter than a traditional Stratocaster pickup. So at that stage, the famous Telecaster was born. And while it was originally, you know, used a lot with you know, country artists and later to R&B artists, there's a lot of rock guys that pick these things up. The other thing that was kind of different about the Telecaster is that most of the Gibson guitars, which were their biggest rival, obviously, along with Rickenbacker, the Gibson guitars had their necks were glued on to the body with glue, and Fender opted to have a neck that screwed on or bolted on. So they used screws. Actually, they used screws instead of bolts, but it's called a bolt-on neck. It's still called that to this day. So you'll see a lot of the Fenders with screws in the back, the bolt-on necks, whereas a lot of the Gibsons have the glued-on neck, and that's still true today. So it's just kind of an interesting different take on how to get the neck on the guitar. At any rate, what they ended up doing with the Telecaster when they put it out, it was really, really successful. And then through the years, they have been used by a large portion of people, and then it's undergone a bunch of changes. So the original Telecaster and sort of the classic one is just a solid piece of wood. There's no chambers in it. There's no holes in it. It's not semi-hollow or hollow body or whatever. But they've come out with a large number of variations of it. And the original Telecaster, when it was still the Esquire and the Broadcaster, had this kind of weird angle to the pickups. To the tone controls and the to change the lever to change between the pickups, the switch. And they ended up making it parallel with the guitar instead of this weird angle they started out with. And I'm not so sure that was a good idea or a bad idea, but be that as it may, that's what it evolved into. So once that came out and they started selling, then through the years they have done different additions on it. So the original Telecaster, which is still, as I said, the traditional one today, has one volume for both pickups and one tone control for both pickups, and then a selector switch, which goes from the bridge to the neck pickup and then in between engages both pickups simultaneously. So they now have a boatload of variations, a thing called a thin line, which is essentially a semi-hollow body. And I think that came out in 68 or 69 originally, done originally by a German luthier who was working with Fender at the time. And that had the same switch configuration and pickup configuration and tone and volume configuration. It just had one F-hole in it because it was a semi-hollow body, and so it was kind of this variation on it that folks could pick up, and it was a thinner body than most traditional, like Gibson ES guitars, Electro Spanish. So then they have the Custom, which has, you know, different volume and tone controls, and some of them have a mini humbucker in the neck position. Some of them have a humbucker in the neck position. So there's all these different variations. And the Deluxe, which has two what Fender calls wide range humbucker pickups, which have a different range frequency than a Gibson Les Paul pickup, let's say. And then you have the Telecaster Plus, which has, you know, all kinds of lace sensor pickups in it, which don't give the hum as much, and it gives some more, for lack of a better term, balls to the guitar. And then they have the Tele Junior, which has basically PAF, P90 type pickups in it, which are like soap bar pickups, kind of like some Les Pauls. You know, and then you have the thing called the Cabernito, which has TV Jones pickups, which are like a Gretsch. And then you have these special artist editions. So you have, like, for example, most people don't know that John Five of Marilyn Manson and, you know, in the last 12 or so years, Rob Zombie fame, plays a Telecaster predominantly, but he has a model that was designed for him. It's got two extremely hot pickups in it. And, you know, the neck pickup sounds like a Telecaster, but the bridge pickup does not sound like it. It's like, you know, in your face. Here it is, loud as hell, and has a very unusual headstock, too. It has a really, really different headstock. So you have that sort of thing. You have the James Burton Telecaster, which most of you know was Ricky Nelson. He was a Sun studio musician who loved Telecasters and also played with Ricky Nelson. And when Ricky Nelson died, played with Elvis until Elvis's death. And his particular Telecaster has the body of a Telecaster, but the guts of a Stratocaster. So it's a three pickup model with a five way switch that basically has Stratocaster pickups in it. So evidently, James Burton, kind of like myself, was not a Strat freak. I don't know why he didn't care for Strats very much, but he just loved Tele, so he put the Strat guts in the Tele body, so it's a Tele that sounds like a Strat, essentially. So it's you have these just huge amount of variations, you know. But what most people don't know is there's a lot of rock people that use Telecasters. Jeff Beck, for example, with the Yardbirds. Now, currently, he's been using a Strat for I don't know how many years now, you know, 25, 30 years, I don't know. But for many, 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 many years, he used a Telecaster. Sid Barrett, the original guitar player of Pink Floyd, had a custom Tele. Roy Buchanan, really great blues guy who unfortunately died way before his time, used a Telecaster. And he was actually a big inspiration for Jeff Beck. James Burton, who I mentioned already, was a big Telecaster person. Mike Campbell of Tom Petty had used Telecasters on a lot of their songs, like American Girl, Breakdown. Those are both Telecaster songs. Albert Collins, who was considered, quote-unquote, the master of the Telecaster, had his weird open tuning he used with a capo on the Telecaster. It was really bizarre, but it sounds really awesome. And he's got a particular model that I think Fender puts out from time to time. Steve Cropper from, you know, the Blues Brothers guitar guy, and he's played with everybody and their brother. Sam and Dave, Otis Redding. He was a guitar player for Booker T and the MGs. So Dennis Diaz of Steely Dan, Jerry Donahue of the Hellcasters and Fairport Convention, Bob Dylan when he first came out and played electric was playing a Telecaster. Danny Gatton, probably one of the most amazing unsung heroes of the Telecaster, who had especially Joe Barden pickups in his guitar Telecaster. Just a freaking fabulous guy. Also gone too soon by his own hand. Vince Gill, who got his start with Pure Perry League. Amy, what you going to do? That's Vince Gill, guys and gals who didn't know that. He plays a Telecaster a lot. David Gilmour of Pink Floyd, even though he's known for his signature Stratocaster, he does use Telecasters on some songs, like Run Like Hell, for example, and various things off the Wall. Let's see who else. Oh, George Harrison. Holy shoes, how could I forget him? Yeah, George Harrison had the prototype Rosewood Telecaster on the famous rooftop concert where he plays Let It Be, and he used a Tele on a lot of the Abbey Road songs and the Let It Be songs off those recordings. He had a Rosewood Telecaster, it was solid Rosewood, and there's very, very few of those around. I actually have one. They're pretty amazing. Steve Howe with Yes. Even though he normally is seen playing a Gibson ES, he also uses a customized 1955 Telecaster, I believe. Messing John 5 already, really good stuff. Terry Kath of Chicago Transit Authority, another guy, gone too soon. even though you see him sometimes playing a Strat, he played most of the early stuff and into their mid-career with the Telecaster, and that was one of his major instruments. Richie Kotzen, who plays a souped-up DiMarzio pickup Telecaster, the guy that plays with Winery Dogs, with Billy Sheehan, really good guitar player, plays a Tele. Even though Alex Lifeson of Rush typically plays Gibsons, he has Telecasters, which he uses on live recordings and in studio recording. Muddy Waters, famous blues guy, played a Tele. Mark Bolan played Tele. Buck Owens, which is country guy, obviously. Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, when he was with Yardbirds, played a Telecaster and recorded the first three Zepp albums predominantly on a Telecaster in the studio, even though he played a Gibson Les Paul live. And there's certain iconic songs that are played with the Tele, not off the three first original Zeppelin albums. Most notably, the lead work on Stairway to Heaven is played with a Telecaster. So, as you can see, there are a lot of folks. Billy Squire, very, very well known Telecaster player. Bruce Springsteen, Telecaster. Joe Strummer of The Clash. Andy Summers of The Police. Pete Townsend for a section of The Who played a Telecaster. So there are a lot of folks who play Teles that aren't country guys and gals. So for anybody who thought a Telecaster was just for country and R&B and some blues, think again. There, you know, it depends on what you got hooked up to the Tele, what kind of amp you're using, and which version of the Telecaster you're using. So that's kind of my quick and dirty take on the Fender Tele. And it's personally a guitar that I love. I own about 10 of them, and they're all different, of course. But I really, really like them. And, you know, I don't use them for everything. That's why I have, you know, a shoot ton of guitars, so I can use the guitars that match what I'm doing. But they're certainly a favorite of mine, since I'm not a Strat guy very much. Just mainly due to where the controls are. It's not that I don't like the tone of a Strat or the looks of a Strat. It's just that home controls are just in the wrong place for me. I hit them all the time. So I love the Teles and the offsets, the Jaguars and the Jazzmasters and that sort of thing. And now Fender's come out with this thing called Parallel Universe, which is a new line of guitars that mixes and blends aspects of other guitars. So they've got one that's a Telecaster that's, you know, got like a Stratocaster neck and all kind of crazy stuff. Actually, Clapton, when he was playing with Blind Faith, when they did their opening gig at Hyde Park, had this really weird Telecaster with a Stratocaster neck on it that he had done at the custom shop. And the first time I saw the video of that, I went, okay, it's a Telecaster, but that's a weird flipping neck, and that's because it's a Strat neck. So, yeah. Even though he's most notably known for playing Stratocasters, right? He has played Teles before, and early in his early career with Cream and John Mayall and some of the Yardbird stuff, he was playing Gibsons, Les Pauls particularly. But he's played Les Pauls, he's played SGs, he's played Firebirds, and he's played Explorers. So those are all very, very well-known Gibson guitars. And I forgot what the story was, how he ended up with a Strat. But that's kind of been his go-to guitar for, you know, years and years and years and years and years and years. So kind of like Jeff Beck now. But both those guys did not always play Strats. So there you go.
Fair enough. Okay, thank you for that. Again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called Is There Anybody Out There? Suicide Support System Failure. So the very first episode of this radio show ever was on musicians and suicide back in July of 2016. Episodes 9, 10, and 11 back in November and December of 2016 focused on depression around the holidays, which is a frequent time when there's an uptick in suicides and attempts. Episode 9 was specifically on holiday depression. Episodes 21 and 22 in May of 2017 were another follow-up two-part show on suicide. Episode 21 was about some of the guilt, rage, despair, and other destructive feelings that suicidal people often feel, which in turn can impede their support system from working. Episode 22 was about Chris Cornell's suicide, which was right on the heels in between the two episodes. The Baker Act laws from Florida, Project Semicolon, and the Netflix TV series 13 Reasons Why. Episode 23 was on resilience, which is woefully lacking by so many people and is not really taught and only encouraged as a shaming mechanic, implying those who are not resilient are weak, worthless, and inferior. And recently, episode 45 was specifically on suicide among veterans. Tonight's show is going to take a look at the painful truth about the crisis, support, end of suicide, and self-harm emergencies, that most such gestures are ignored or not taken seriously by the targets. The truth is that a dark part of this pathology is that being in the heat of it frequently makes the person going through it unwilling or even unable to ask for help. They are frightened, mistrusting, overwhelmed, mentally scattered, despondent, and or similar breakdowns and feelings. Often they either believe offers of help are empty gestures to receive the status of a supportive friend, but that you wouldn't actually stay up with them at 3 a.m. on a work or school night while they are having racking sobs about their life, or else they might not want to be seen as a bother to others and would literally rather die than put someone out. Or they may also feel that strangers on a hotline or in an emergency room don't know them and wouldn't understand what they need, or that nobody can fix their problems, so why bother asking? We have this detached notion in American popular culture that if we post a few memes about suicide or support on social media, or we tell people that we will be there for them or that we understand, or other similar well-intentioned public gestures, that those around us in depression, emotional crisis, or having suicidal ideations will suddenly feel inspired to reach out to us or call a hotline or their doctor and ask for help. Most of us want to help and say or do the right thing that will save a life. We don't know when it's okay to be pushy or when it's best to just shut up and let someone be. On top of all these issues, we've now learned that many of the support systems supposedly in place to help the depressed and suicidal are failing them. People don't get help in time. They get useless offers of help. They are postponed. Programs and facilities are losing funding and quality staff because of budget shenanigans. Public support for these entities is low because pop culture has made it popular and acceptable to bully and shame others for any weaknesses or perceived flaws, including depression and suicidal ideations. They don't have the mental wherewithal to ask for their own help or to indicate to others that they need it in a timely manner. Tonight, we're going to get more in depth about the systemic failures of suicide support systems in our country, as well as helping our listeners understand the mindset and expectations of those suffering with these pathologies so that we can all help more effectively and have realistic expectations about what it is in our power to do. So tonight we will discuss, first, suicide on the rise, articles dealing with the uptick in suicides and self-harm and contributing factors. Second, resources. What are some of the more commonly referred resources for those in distress? What can one expect when contacting them? What are their limitations and what is their authority here? Number three, systemic failures. Recounting anecdotes and accounts of ways in which these resources have failed to do the job we assume that they're doing. And four, how to help. Why these failures are happening? What is in our power to do about it? Pardon me just a moment. Sorry, I had a cough. How can family, friends, laypersons, and professionals all be better prepared to respond in an effective way to those who are depressed, despondent, or suicidal? And before we begin, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add.
No, I'm good for right now. Thank you.
Okay. So the first part that we are going to talk about is suicide on the rise. So these are statistics and articles dealing with the uptick in suicides and self-harm and contributing factors. So first thing is who, what kinds of people are in need of support services concerning depression, emotional crisis or despondency, or suicidal ideations. Usually it is a person clinically at risk of or actively having depression, emotional crisis, despondency, or suicidal ideations. Someone who has lost someone to suicide. Someone who is constantly contacted by someone else threatening self-harm or suicide. Someone who reasonably believes someone else or even themselves is at risk, even if threats or cries for help have not yet been made. Someone who has made failed attempts, whether by choice or by luck. Suicidal and self-harm mentality. The source for some of these notes is a website from Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, DBSA of Chicago. The most important thing to remember about suicidal thoughts is that they are symptoms of a treatable illness associated with fluctuations in the body and brain chemistry. They are not character flaws or signs of personal weakness, nor are they conditions that will just go away on their own. Depression and the depressive phase of bipolar disorder may cause symptoms such as the following: intense sadness, hopelessness, lethargy, loss of appetite, disruption of sleep, decreased ability to perform usual tasks, or loss of interest in once pleasurable activities. Taken together, these symptoms may lead someone to consider suicide. However, with proper treatment, the majority of people do feel better and regain hope. During severe depression, the systems that regulate emotion become disturbed. People in the middle of a severe depression often only think of things that are dark and sad. Physicians refer to this as selective memory, only remembering the bad times or the disappointments in life. And with that, I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if you have anything to add here.
Yeah, excuse me. At some point, what happens is the more into the rabbit hole, for lack of a better term, somebody finds themselves because of depression, their brain sort of goes into what I describe as survival mode. So most people, when they're presented with a problem or difficulties in life, they have all these problem-solving tactics they use to get themselves out of it or to figure ways around it or to minimize it. When you become too depressed into this hole, so to speak, your brain stops using creative ways to problem solve, excuse me, because it feels as if almost it's dying. So you start to do and think of only essential things that you need to do, life support, for lack of a better term. And so what happens is you're thinking outside the box. Your ability to creatively thinking and getting things done and yada, 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 all go out of the window. And you can only see the light and the future in front of you, your present, and the stuff behind you. It's almost like you're in a tunnel, and you can't really see the light at the end of the tunnel. So you look at what's happening at yourself, and you, excuse me, sort of see what's going on with yourself, and you would just assume, since it sucks right now, that life is going to continue to get bad, it's going to continue to get worse, it's never going to get better, and because of that, you know, why should you put up with the crap, basically? So a lot of people will see, as a result of that, suicide as being the only viable solution to end their stuff, if you will, because they don't have the ability to see outside the box. And so that is, you know, that's a looking at it from a neurological standpoint. That's really what's happening. So you're right. It has nothing to do with weakness or lack of character. These folks really are not operating with a full brain, for lack of a better term, when they get to that point.
Okay, fair enough. And very important for our listeners to bear in mind. We're going to get into this further in the third section. So part two is resources, which is what are some of the most commonly referred resources for those in distress? What can one expect when contacting them? What are their limitations and what is their authority? Now, some of this I did skim over because there's a lot of data here, but I will give you some chunks of information. One of the biggest ones is phone hotlines, and especially the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. This is a national network of local crisis centers that provides free confidential emotional support to people in suicidal crisis or emotional distress. They're open 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. Their number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Also, all calls from the number 1-800-SUICIDE have been rerouted into the Lifeline network, and this has been going on since March of 2007. They took that number over. You can also reach the Veterans Crisis Line by calling either number. And they have a blurb on their website. What should I expect during a Lifeline chat session? Our goal is to help you reduce stress and feel empowered to make healthy decisions. You will be asked questions regarding your safety, feelings, social situation, and if you have any thoughts of suicide. If a chat counselor feels that you are in danger, they will speak with you about accessing emergency services and or gather additional contact information to ensure your safety. The chat counselor will work with you to create a safety plan if necessary. Some other resources are the website American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, ASFP.org. Their website and other websites that collect links to many resources, and the resources are typically regional. In-person support groups, a lot of these are run by nonprofits, churches, sometimes clinicians and doctors will run some. Online support groups often run the same as in-person support groups, although typically they can be peer-led rather than directed by a doctor or a counselor. Medical doctors, general practitioners, ER staff, and clinics. And last and most important, mental health professionals, usually psychologists and psychiatrists, but anyone that you can get access to if needed. One of the limitations is that pretty much all of these resources depend on the patient contacting them unless they are court-ordered after a suicide attempt. They can do little or nothing for those who do not want to attempt. And at this point, I will pause and check in again with you, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, the problem with some of these self-referrals is they don't really think that, there's anything out there that can help them, so they don't see the need to call, so they don't, which is sad because a lot of these folks could be helped.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a good segue to part three, which is the meat and potatoes of why we're doing this episode, systemic failures. And these are anecdotes and accounts of ways in which these resources have failed to do the job that we all assume that they are doing. So first problem is passiveness. And this is similar to what you just mentioned. One of the biggest problems is that pretty much all resources require the person in distress or another adult on their behalf to request help. And often the person in distress will refuse help or at least be completely passive about any actions. And as long as they are medically and legally allowed to make their own decisions, there's nothing further to be done. Second problem is a self-awareness failure. In order to understand why certain approaches don't work very well, we have to understand what's going on in the minds and thoughts of a person who has depression, emotional crisis or despondency, or suicidal ideations. We often make suggestions by some random guideline rather than actively engaging and finding out where that specific person is in their distress. They may have a pathology that is giving them thoughts that are not their true wishes or otherwise interfering with their ability to process reality and make decisions for themselves. They may be schizotypal in some way and lack the ability to cope with adult real-life decisions. They may be paranoid. They may have PTSD. They may have just had a stressful life event, such as financial loss, a death in the family or of a close friend, a new and debilitating medical diagnosis, a crime against them such as assault, harassment and stalking, rape, disfiguring or handicapping injury, or other traumatic events. They may be unable to process their fear, hypervigilance, lack of a sense of safety, etc. They may have had a series of events in life which have robbed them of their hope or feelings of control over their own lives and future. They could be isolated, poorly educated, jobless, homeless, under an addiction, in financial ruin or poverty, elderly and lacking appropriate support, or other situations that can seem insurmountable. They may feel nothing can be fixed, so why keep living? The next problem is abilities and access, and by this I mean access to resources and help. They may, through a variety of the above conditions that I've just mentioned, lack basic resources which might have mitigated the situation before it became dire. They may lack insurance, transportation. They may be lucky enough to have a job, but they risk losing it by taking time off for appointments. They may be unable or unwilling to engage in basic hygiene and self-care, which in turn can spiral into worse things. They may not live close to a doctor who will treat them, especially if they're not in a metropolitan area. They may require inpatient or all-day short-term treatment, which would result in risking a job or calling attention to extended absences that are noticed by friends and family, and thus raising a litany of nosy questions and so forth. As far as abilities, people who are disabled or in some way unable to communicate traditionally are even more limited in availability of resources. Not all resources have accommodations for ADA issues, deaf and hard of hearing persons, or blind persons, etc. The next problem is medical staff demeanor and awareness, and this is a big one. An alarming number of staff in medical facilities have inadequate, if outright no training, in how to deal with suicidal ideations. I will summarize a recent real event shared with me confidentially that serves as an example of how non-mental health medical staff can egregiously fail a patient who needs help. Personally identifying details have been removed from this anecdote. So bear in mind, I've sanitized this, but this is in fact a real story. I'm protecting the person who told it to me. Recently, a patient in their 20s with a known history of depression and anxiety and actively under psychological care and medications for their condition was admitted to a hospital for an unrelated major surgical procedure which involved serious body alterations. The patient had suicidal ideations on admission. There were no suicide precautions instituted. The following day, the patient was despondent about their surgery, and the nurse that day was able to comfort them, but had been told nothing about the prior suicidal ideations the day before. There were no notes about the problems with admission, nor that the patient's psychologist had already been called, and the first assessment the prior day, not by the patient's psychologist, had seemed acceptable at the time. The patient proceeded to have a full-on meltdown, and suicide precautions finally happened. A psych consult did not happen until the following day, so now we're 2 days in. The in-house psych consult was an hour late. The patient's family was absolutely livid. They had requested a psych eval on admission 2 days prior. The in-house tried to contact their psychologist and psychiatrist, but those people were unavailable as this now had stretched into the weekend. Finally, a covering psych contacted the in-house psych and gave an overview of traditional protocols for that patient. Fortunately, the patient tends to have reactions but is not considered an active danger to themselves. The surgical team did not follow protocol with this patient. No information was provided regarding psychiatric contact. A psych consult was not ordered per protocol. Other nurses did not seem aware of this during the handoff, as no one told the duty nurse yesterday that this was a continuation from admission. In summary, many medical staff are poorly equipped or trained, how to respond to unrelated suicidal episodes, which can result in failure to help a patient in need in a timely manner. And even if there are protocols in place, they don't follow them. And sadly, stories just like this one are not that rare. Another problem is some people don't want help. This is one of the hardest points about these kinds of situations that a lot of people don't really want to face. Another unfortunate fact is that there are people in the world who cause themselves distress by being misanthropic, having out-of-control cluster B behaviors such as histrionic, borderline, or antisocial, or other tendencies. They alienate parts of their support system, even if they are authentically still in distress and need help. This especially happens in families where no one wants to go take care of grandpa because basically he's an asshole, that sort of thing. Another problem is hotlines and other layperson responders. We were told another personal anecdote, this time about someone who called a suicide hotline a few weeks ago, and the operator took their name and number for a callback. I do not actually know how common this is, but I was led to believe that is super rare, because when a person actually gets the wherewithal to call, they're in full-on distress. So postponing it is very dangerous. The callback was finally received 48 hours later. Fortunately, this specific caller did not follow through and take their own life, but they certainly could have by then. Another failure is lack of promotion. A great number of the resources listed here tonight, I did not know about off the top of my head until doing research for tonight's script. Most of these organizations are nonprofits and staffed by volunteers. Many are sponsored by churches, a few by doctors, counselors, hospitals, and clinics. They lack the budget, resources, and staff to make sure their existence is known by the people who need them. And the last one is failure to connect. By the time a person reaches a level of depression or despondency to where they are considering heavy self-harm or suicide, there has already been a history of disconnection and feelings of lack of support leading up to this point. They feel that there are few or no family members, friends, doctors, trusted adults, or even peers and strangers who understand what is wrong in their lives, or at least that nobody really cares enough about it. And sadly, they are not always wrong, which further feeds this toxic thinking. And here I'm going to break and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see what you want to add.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. So the next part, very important also, is how to help. And some of these are from the point of view of outsiders, and some of these are for the patients, the targets that are experiencing the pathology. So this is a bit about why these failures are happening, what is in our power to do about it, and what is not. How can family, friends, laypersons, and professionals all be better prepared to respond in an effective way to those who are depressed, despondent, or suicidal? First, allow inconvenience and actively make that known. And this is for lay people, friends, family, and so forth. One prevalent theme, both before and after a suicide attempt or actual suicide, is the person feeling, correctly or not, that they don't want to bother people or put them out. Much damage has been done in our culture from older generations praising the notion of never being a burden on anyone. We are not saying that one should freely just burden others with impunity. What we're saying is that two things we can collectively do to improve this climate of suicides are the following. First, on the part of family, friends, and so on, actively let those around you know that it is okay to ask your help. Take a 3 a.m. phone call. Invite someone to coffee. Don't just post a tired old meme you didn't even write and think that makes you sound invested in others. Speak your own original words to point at yourself and that you gladly accept a call for help, and then do be there if asked. Physically spend time with them. Make time. Sometimes you needn't say anything, but that you showed up says everything. Second, if you are the person in distress, do everything in your power to let a trusted person know how you prefer being approached and trust those who offer help do mean it, and you should accept it. Easier said than done, which is what this show is about, but please do your sincere best to let them know what you need. Next, make resources easily available and easily known. This is an enormous undertaking, so my advice is that unless you are financially in a position to do something such as start your own foundation or endowment fund, that if you want to help make these more available and easily known, make this a project with friends, local charities, nonprofits, and support entities. If you do want to make a difference, I would begin with compiling the active resources in your town, your city, or your county. Google and ask around and try to find as many phone lines, websites, online and in-person support groups, doctors, mental health professionals, workshops, shelters, county resources, crisis centers, and anything else you can imagine is useful. Start working on a master list. Ask around if anyone knows of someone who already started a master list. Make it a project to get an updated roster into the form of a postcard or a wallet card, and find a way to fund getting them printed up and handed out to places that may reach people, offices, certain kinds of businesses, leave a few strays in restrooms, on buses, in clubs and cafes, near churches, rec centers, shelters, anything else you can think of. Leave some with the facilities you list on there. Making this information portable, centralized, and easy to access will encourage people to hang on to it and use it. Next, do not shame mental health nor tolerate it in others. There has been a stigma against mental health in this country for decades. People make comments, whether on purpose or just carelessly not thinking, that lead others to believe they are lesser because they feel help or need help or feel despair. Some social accommodation has been made towards military, PTSD sufferers, and suicidal vets, but many in our society turn pain into a contest where the exact same pathologies in civilians are a source of shameful weakness and worthlessness. Sufferers are mocked and bullied relentlessly, called rude names and cuss words, harassed and stalked for revealing their pain on social media or confiding in friends in person, which only serves to bully them back into silence. Don't tolerate this in your families, in your circles of friends, in the workplace, at clubs, social media, or any other gatherings of people. Your ambivalence may fail to save a life that matters to you. Next, if you are the person feeling suicidal, and again, source for these notes is Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, DBSA of Chicago, what you can do to fight suicidal thoughts. Keep a journal to write down your thoughts. Each day, write about your hopes for the future and the people you value in your life. Go out with friends and family. It may help you feel better to visit or allow visits from family and friends who are caring and can understand. Avoid drugs and alcohol. Most deaths by suicide result from sudden, uncontrolled impulses. Since drugs and alcohol contribute to such impulses, it's essential to avoid them. Drugs and alcohol also interfere with the effectiveness of medications prescribed for depression. Next, learn to recognize your earliest warning signs of a suicidal episode. There are often subtle warning signs your body will give you when an episode is developing. Next is warning signs of impending suicidal behavior, again from DBSA of Chicago. Feelings of despair and hopelessness. Oftentimes, individuals with depression talk with those closest to them about extreme feelings of hopelessness, despair, and self-doubt. The more extreme these feelings become, and the more often they're described as unbearable, the more likely it is that the idea of suicide has entered the person's mind. Taking care of personal affairs. When a person is winding up his or her affairs and making preparations for the family's welfare after he or she is gone, there is a good chance the individual is considering self-harm or suicide. Now, mind you, some people do this just to be practical and get it done a lot earlier. be sure that you know which one you're dealing with before you say anything. Next, rehearsing suicide. Rehearsing suicide or seriously discussing specific suicide methods are also indications of a commitment to follow through. Even if the person's suicidal intention seems to come and go, such preparation makes it that much easier for the individual to give in to a momentary impulse. Drug or alcohol abuse. Someone with worsening depression may abuse drugs or alcohol. These substances can worsen symptoms of depression or mania, decrease the effectiveness of medication, enhance impulsive behavior, and severely cloud judgment. And last, and this one may sound a little strange to you guys, beginning to feel better. It might sound strange, but someone dealing with depression may be more likely to attempt suicide just when he or she seems to have passed an episode's low point and be on the way to recovery. Experts believe there's an association between early recovery and increased likelihood of suicide. As depression begins to lift, a person's energy and planning capabilities may return more fully before the suicidal thoughts have disappeared, increasing the chances of an attempt. Studies show that the period 6 to 12 months after hospitalization is when patients are most likely to consider or reconsider suicide. And last thing you can do, make the first move because they won't. Approach the other person discreetly and privately, but do not promise them confidentiality from doctors or other crisis personnel. It is better not to lie than to say anything it takes to make them stop, because destroyed trust is often a suicide trigger. Privately, tell them that you noticed whatever disturbing behavior or comment tipped you off, and let them know that you are willing to talk with them if they would like, or just sit with them and listen, or even coexist in a safe silence. They might say no, but many times they will agree. If this is relevant, encourage them to seek professional help ASAP. Be willing to help them do research into who is a good fit, because finding a good psychologist is a huge chore. They may lack insurance, funds, transportation. Offer to help as you are able. The process will seem daunting, so you have to be resilient enough for both of you. Lastly, remind them and remember yourself that mental health is a lifelong process, just like your physical health can be. You don't take pills for 6 months and everything is gone, and that is okay. This may upset them, but do what you can to treat this as a typical medical process that most of us do. They may expect a magic pill because we see that in the movies or on TV, but it isn't how real life works. And with that, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you have anything to add.
Yeah, a couple of things. The reason is you see people sometimes complete suicide after their depression or anxiety has lifted a little bit is because now they have the psychological energy and physical energy to do something about it. Usually, if they're in uber crisis mode, and particularly if they've been depressed or anxious for a long time, both of these conditions sap the body of physical energy as the emotional conditions deplete the body's resources, and so you physically get tired and weak and don't have any energy. So it's kind of like, you know, I'd kill myself, but I'm too lazy to go find the gun and load it with bullets and put it to my head, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When they get more energy, sometimes they'll go, you know what, I don't want to go through this crap again. And so before they're like totally back, they'll start to think about, you know, maybe I should be proactive and get rid of myself before this stuff happens a second time. So that's why you see those statistics. And tagging on to that, if you're a person who has a history of that, or if you know somebody that has history of that, particularly if they're living in your home, there's two things you want to do. Lock up or get rid of all and any drugs that you have, including alcohol, because that, as you mentioned earlier, is going to significantly decrease their judgment. And unfortunately, the drug of choice for most depressed people is alcohol, which is a central nervous system depressant, which is the last flipping drug they ought to be doing, but it's what they do. So you want to get rid of all that stuff out of the house, or lock it up, or make it, you know, unavailable to them, because, you know, you're just – you're feeding the fire that you don't want to feed. The second thing is get rid of any and all weapons or anything that might be construed as a weapon in your home. Hunting knives, obviously guns, rifles, whatever. Get rid of all that crap in your house. If you have, you know, if you're a cooking person and you have a lot of sharp knives, you may want to put them someplace where you have a lock on them. I mean, you can't be too careful with these folks. And, you know, having easy access to weapons, especially guns, if because males typically use guns to kill themselves with. That's just a statistic we know. So you definitely want to get rid of any and all firearms out of the house, or put them in a safe or lock them in a cabinet and make sure that you're the only person with the key. And if you're a suicidal person and you know you have a tendency and you're thinking that way, while you're still in your right mind, give them to a friend to hold for you. Give them to your parents if they're still alive. Give them to somebody. Get them out of your house. Don't tempt yourself. Be smart about this stuff. Be proactive. So when you have a little bit of conscience about yourself, so to speak, and some energy to do it, call some people over. If you're too energy drained and tired or whatever, call some people over, tell them where the shit is, and get them to get it out of your house. Don't keep it in there so that you have easy access to it. Because it's kind of like if you're trying to stop smoking cigarettes, you make it hard on you. You know, you put them in a place where you lock them in a car, you put the lighter in the glove compartment, and, you know, you put the keys to your car under your pillow in your bedroom, and so you have to go through all this folderol to get to the stuff before you use the cigarettes, and by the time you do that, you've talked yourself out of it. That's kind of the same thing we're doing with these suicidal things, but you just want to get them out of the house if you can. You don't want... You know, you don't want to be tempted around there. And if that's, for whatever reason, that's not possible, and you don't want to give them away or sell them or whatever, then put them in a locked drawer, put them in a locked cabinet, take the keys to the cabinet, you know, put them somewhere, put two locks on the door, get two keys and put them in two different places that you got to hunt and pace to get them. Because by the time you get them, usually what we know from the research literature with addictions, for example, if you're going to relapse, whether it's smoking or whatever, if you can kind of put a lid on your id for anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute, you can usually talk yourself out of it. So it doesn't take a whole lot of time to come to your senses with those kind of things. Depression, anxiety, particularly if they're chronic, it's going to take you longer than that. So the harder you can make it on yourself to get access to this stuff, the less likelihood you have of doing something you might not live to regret later. So.
Got it.
There you go.
Thank you. And with that, is there anything else that you want to add on any other part of the show before we wrap?
I think you're good. This is certainly, you know, a concern, because you're seeing people everywhere doing it. And
okay, we're having another technical difficulty. Apologies to our audience and to Dr. Mathis. I hope I am not overstepping, but I'm going to go ahead and wrap the show. This concludes our show on suicide support system failure, and we hope that our listeners have a better understanding about the fact that mental health is not all just about damage control, and those who are doing well in their adjustments have plenty of room to flourish in life. But also to understand what it is like for a suicidal person and why some of our pat answers and the first things we say can kind of just seem like we're repeating a lot of rhetoric, but we're not really invested in helping people. People who are despondent can sense this. And so I invite our listeners to become authentically inconvenienced and invested in people around them, because the people in distress are not going to ask you for that, but it is desperately what they need. So in closing, on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening and give appreciation also to those of you joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We will see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, July 25th at 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for a new topic brought to you right here on Blog Talk Radio. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everyone, and rock on.